In today's episode, I am having, oh gosh, what a conversation. What a conversation I've had with Andy Callow. Andy is the Chief Digital and Transformation Officer at Nottingham University's Hospital Trust. The Trust is one of the largest NHS trusts in the country and employs over 19,000 staff. And in this conversation, Andy talks about his journey into proactive allyship, the how, the why, and the what. He shares with us about how he is activating his executive sponsor role of the Trust's Race Equality Network, what he's doing, how he does it, how it works in practice. And he also shares insights about some of the other initiatives that the Trust is doing and that he's driving and leading on to really look at how they are creating and embedding a more inclusive culture and creating opportunities to support the progression of underrepresented staff across the Trust. It is so insightful, and Andy has been brave and honest in what he shared. There aren't many people who have spoken in the way that he has as an NHS leader about his journey and the practical advice that he's offering to others. When we talk here in Bravery in the Boardroom about what's helping to turn the dial now, this episode, I think, has so much gold in it about what you can be doing and what you can run with, because Andy's already started to test and trial some of the things that he speaks about very openly and very clearly in this conversation today. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Hi, I'm all right. Thank you.
Well, welcome to Bravery in the Boardroom. We were just speaking before we pressed record, wasn't we, about it's taken a little while to coordinate, but it's wonderful to have you here.
I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you. So where do I always start? It would be great for you to tell our listeners a little bit about you and what you do.
Yeah, so I'm the Chief Digital and Transformation Officer at Nottingham University Hospitals. That means I've got responsibility for digital data technology, improvement and transformation, and also the project management office. So large portfolio, I'm a member of the board, and I'm also privileged to be the exec sponsor for the REACH staff network. And I'm sure we'll get into that in today's conversation.
We will. And how long have you been at Nottingham?
2 years now.
Okay, tell me a little bit about what you did prior to that.
So I spent 4 years at Kettering and Northampton Hospitals. They were in a group model. I was the Chief Digital Information Officer there. And then just before I left, I was briefly the acting Chief Executive for 4 months in that space. And then prior to that, I was at NHS Digital as part of the national team for a while. And I did was Programme Director for the NHS app, which was like just an amazing period in my career.
Okay, so all things digital.
Yes. So I started off life doing electronics as a kid. I spent all my pocket money, all my time like doing electronics and things. So that was really sort of the start of technology. And then as I got into it, I started doing more and getting into writing software as well as stuff. So I guess my professional time is a software engineer.
Okay. So be good to understand a little bit more from you about your career journey as well. But before I ask that, I always like to kind of start from that leadership perspective of our guests. So how would you describe your leadership style in 3 words?
So collaborative, open, and I really sort of thought about this third word. Mm-hmm. Expectant, I think, is what I would say. And I think that's because, and I probably will qualify that because I have pretty high standards and I sort of have an expectation that we're continually improving and making things better. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that I will hold people to account and make sure that they are doing what they say they're going to do. And that's probably not the easiest all the time.
And I suppose that's a great leadership quality to have, being the kind of chief transformation officer as well, isn't it? Because you're the person in charge of driving that change and kind of keeping the momentum going.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. I hear that. Okay. So let me ask that question now then. You said a little bit about, growing up, software engineer by background, and then kind of into the boardroom. Mm. What helped you to get there? What helped those steps to kind of move forward in your journey?
So I think there's a few things in it. So firstly, I worked in local government for a while and there was definitely somebody in local government who saw something in me and gave me opportunities. So I was picked out to be part of a special project that meant I was like at high profile, spent some time with it, a lot of time with the chief executive as part of that. And so that sort of raised my my profile. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other part of that is you got to deliver. So I did deliver it in that. And then there's I guess along the way, different times, people have taken a chance on me. So when I went to NHS Digital, I'd never been in the NHS before. I'd certainly not my first job was managing the NHS website, which is about 50 million hits a month on it. So big, high scale. And I'd never done anything of that scale, but somehow some of the delivery evidence I was able to give sort of persuaded someone, yeah, we'll give you a chance. And then when I moved out from NHS Digital into the acute sector, I'd never worked in the acute hospital. I'd been on a board of a very, very small company that was owned within the local authority. But again, somebody gave me a chance in that space. And then somebody gave me a chance to be acting chief executive. So all those things, I think, around somebody seeing something in me and willing to give me that opportunity. But I think, I guess what I'll come back to and what I've said to when people have sort of said what's happened is it's really about a track record of delivery, I think. It's about being able to point to concrete things to say, you know what, this was a really tricky thing and I managed to get this over the line, of course, with help from other people. But, you know, I'm able to evidence that.
Okay. And any challenges along the way? So in that kind of path, was it smooth or was there any bumps in the road?
So I definitely know that I had a bit of a moment where I was going off the path of my sort of the passion that drove me. So when I was working in local government, the good thing about working in large organisations, as you know, is there's opportunity for progression. Yeah. And, you know, every 18 months or 2 years, you can take on something else. And I got to the point where I was just applying for the next promotion, regardless of actually whether it was something I really, really wanted, you know, because it was the next thing. And I went for two jobs and I didn't get either of them. And I had a bit of an epiphany, I guess, of like saying, do you know what? What I'm trying to do here is stray away from that 15-year-old me who was absolutely mad on the technology you know, electronics. And so I've sort of tried to say, you know, as I go through, I need to stay true to my 15-year-old self along the way. And so so that's been my guiding principle of like, you know, is it, would my 15-year-old self be proud of what I'm doing right now, I suppose?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question to ask, right? You said something in there about, you know, every 18 months to 2 years, you kind of started to move on. And when you're in a large organization, there's usually opportunity. I know from conversations that me and you've had before, we know that unfortunately that's not the scenario for everyone. Mm. And that's part of why we're speaking today, isn't it? How do we help to foster and ensure that there is opportunity for all? And like you said, for people who can deliver and who want to progress, that is a kind of equal and equitable playing field. So you've been sharing a lot, haven't you? I don't know if by choice, but I know you've been brave enough is what I would say. You've been brave enough to share your journey into what you coin as proactive allyship. And I understand that first part of the point, particularly around race equality. Mm-hmm. And I know you've got a blog on it. So tell me a little bit more about why and where did that stem from?
Yeah.
How does that connect to, you know, your story and journey almost?
Yeah. So I guess it comes from one of ignorance. I can't describe it anything other than that. So I was born in rural Lincolnshire in Boston, famous for potatoes and not so famous for Boston United. I've got to get that plug in. In that area, predominantly white population, the highest area voting for Brexit back in the day. They returned a reform candidate in the recent election. And so, you know, very non-cosmopolitan sort of environment. So that, I think that probably gives a bit of context of where I came from. So I hardly knew any non-white people in my early years. My parents ate really conservatively, so I didn't eat rice until I was 17. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a curry until I went to university to 19. So, you know, very much a very constrained or lack completely uncosmopolitan environment. Mm-hmm. And so, I I went to university, very cosmopolitan city, but really I don't think I recognized what racism was going on around me. And, you know, I had numerous opportunities. You know, Stephen Lawrence came along, Mark Duggan, other situations that really just passed me by, if I'm being really, really honest. And, and really it wasn't until George Floyd's death that sort of was this wake-up call, and that coincided with being asked to be the executive sponsor of the REACH network at Kettering Hospital. And it also coincided with reading the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been almost evangelical about that book, actually, since I've got it. 150 pages of absolute brilliant impact, but so insightful. And so that combination of things sort of made me realise that I've got some privilege that I didn't even think about, I didn't even recognise about, and I've got a responsibility with that privilege to do something about it. And so we might sort of talk about this. I read a lot of books in the course of the year, and that's my way of sort of trying to make sense of the world and about stuff that's happening. And so, you know, George Floyd's death prompted me to read White Fragility, and then that sort of helped me realize actually it's not for people from the global majority to teach me about racism.
Yes.
Right. And in fact, me to ask them to do so is actually sort of reinforcing that power dynamic as well. So there's definitely something in there around, you know, gotta learn it for yourself. And so that's kind of been the progress. So, you know, it's not something that I sort of recount with pride, because you know it took until 2020 for me to kind of realize this stuff and then try and go, okay, I need to educate myself and try and do something about it. And you know, that's not always you always feel you're not doing enough, I think, in that space. So that's the kind of the arc of it, you know, and not necessarily feeling like, well, looking back on you'll be able to tell how old I am now. It's 48 years or something before I realised what was going on.
Yeah, and to be able to speak about that, to be able to own that, is not easy, right? It's not easy to be honest in that way, the way that you have. And there's something that I know quite pertinent in what you said there about it's not for colleagues to educate me. It's for me to understand this for myself. I pick up on that point because what I hear quite often is, especially senior colleagues, you know, we want to understand the lived experience of our staff. You know, we want to understand the lived experience of people in our communities who we need to serve better. We need others to hear this, okay? And quite often that's coming from a good intention so that we can do something about it. It doesn't often spark the right action. So in the moment, there is sympathy, definitely. There's even empathy. But what can happen is, when you get to the point of discomfort, people don't continue to take action. And so that point you made there, I just wanted to really kind of tease it out more, because it is really important to take that responsibility to educate yourself where you can, and then think about what you can do, or ask what it is you can do. But I think that point of when we ask people to share their lived experience or to relive their lived experience, I think it's about being very mindful of, it's not necessarily wrong, but be sure that you're going to do something about it. Because otherwise we're marching people up a hill, and to be blunt, we're leaving them there. You know, and all too often that happens, and there isn't a recognition of the impact of that. So I'm pleased that you kind of explained that, where your journey came from, because I think there will be other listeners who may have been thinking, oh, okay, I haven't thought about it in that way, or I have, and that's where I'm at right now. It's not good or bad, right? It's about just being honest about where your journey is and what you're trying to do. So if I probe that point a little bit more, because I know some allies are scared. They're scared to be honest about their journey. They're scared to be open about what they're trying to do, for fear of backlash, for fear of being accused of performative allyship or tick box. What's your reflection on that?
I mean, I don't think I've had any sort of negative experience of it, and I could point in lots of different things where I've just sort of stepped out of my comfort zone, and nothing bad has happened. and that's probably a reflection of my privilege in action, isn't it? Let's face it. But I haven't found any negative impact of it. In the Reach Network, I sort of I've introduced myself. You know, I've got a document that I share out to the group every so often as we get sort of different members, and in that I say, I'm not always going to get it right, but if you tell me, I will sort of try and improve that and correct it. And I decided sort of back, you know, when I had my awakening, if you like, of basically saying, I'd rather say something and get it wrong rather than say silent. You know, I think if I sort of try and say it with good intent, and it's okay if someone corrects me. I'd much rather if somebody correct me and say, you know, that the way you said that just didn't help me, or you know, it's you know, and I'll just try and sort of say, well, is there a better way? How can I say it better? So yes, definitely gone from a position of privilege, I think, by not doing it, or people are saying it behind my back and they've told me, but I don't care.
But so, and bearing that in mind, because for some people they have experienced a kind of backlash, or there's a terminology of losing social capital. So it's really refreshing to hear, well, that hasn't happened to you. So can you tell us a little bit more about the Reach Network? So the Reach Network is your race equality network. So it'd be really good to understand your role a little bit more as exec sponsor.
Yeah. So for me, staff networks are really powerful. They're a way to give employees a voice within the organisation. Mm-hmm. And we've got quite a few different staff networks across the organisation. Chief Executive has really shown his support for them. We sort of get together as the chairs and the exec sponsors and the chief exec on a regular basis and just say how are things going. So it's really important from that point of view. My contribution in that is around listening primarily, to sort of hear what, and then trying to represent the views of the network, mm-hmm. either, you know, in executive meetings or in board meetings. But on a sort of small practical level, mm-hmm. and this comes back to, okay, what can I do in this space that is helpful? Is I hold a couple of hours in my diary each month and basically say to the network, if you want to spend some time with me, I've got these 2 hours booked out, book them in, and really the time is yours. If you want to have a conversation about a job that you're applying for, we can work on an application form. If you're about to have an interview, I'll give you some interview practice. If you just want to share with me some of your lived experience and for me to hear that, happy to do that as well. So basically I've done that, and that's, those slots are always booked up. So you know, that's really good. And I've found, you know, I get a lot out of the learning from that as well. So that's the role of the staff network. But I definitely recognize, for me, it's the network and the chairs that are leading it. I'm there to sort of listen and then replay and express their views into those other forums that I'm part of.
And what a wonderful way you're bringing to life, like the way how you're able to open up your sponsorship. You can then have that available for a wider group of colleagues. I mean, how you do that, it's marvelous. So that's, I think that's a top tip there in terms of how people, because people ask that question quite a lot. Okay, what should our exec sponsor be doing? So if they, sometimes it's, you can see that the dynamic isn't quite working right, or we might not be getting the value that we want from it, but don't necessarily know what we could be doing differently. There's quite a live conversation now about sponsorship. And I think if you talk, you know, you talk or read about career progression, particularly for colleagues who are underrepresented, active sponsorship is something that comes up time and time again. So it's really, really good to hear how you're kind of putting that into practice on a day-to-day basis. So connecting the dots on that then, because like you're saying there, you're trying to support colleagues who want to progress. I mentioned earlier about not everyone having those same opportunities to progress. What in your view should be prioritised then, so that we are seeing more representation and more diversity at senior leadership level in the NHS?
So I think the data exists here. So the I'm probably going to mess up the acronym, but the RES data, yes. The Workforce Race Equality Standard.
That is right.
There we go. Yeah. So that's a trust has nowhere to hide on that. You know, you have the information and you see, well, you know, what's the distribution at different levels around that? Are you representative of your employee base? Are there more colleagues from the global majority who are in a grievance process or mm-hmm. less likely to be shortlisted for a job? You know, so those things are really, really important. And, you know, I think that we need to sort of keep looking at that data and use it. And I know, different people have said, actually, that we don't need more data. The data already mm-hmm. exists. It's mm-hmm. now about what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. And so I think that is an important part of seeing what's happening. One way that we've been trying to do it, so we did, we agreed our workforce improvement strategy last year. And as part of that, we had a number of recommendations, one of which was to work towards a shadow board of our board. And so...
And what's a shadow board for anyone who doesn't
know? So shadow board is the idea is you bring a number of diverse people within to the decision-making space mm-hmm. and basically say, act as an advisory group to say, let me give you some input on some of these decisions that you're making. So... because we're starting this from scratch, what we didn't do, we didn't go straight to do it at the board level. What we've done it for my digital and data strategic committee.
Okay.
So I've set up a shadow committee for my strategic committee. And what we've done is got 12 people brought in from the organisation. They did expressions of interest and did a shortlisting approach. And so that's drawn from, we sort of said, we don't want the normal suspects, right?
Yeah.
We don't want the people who are, already prominent in the organisation, yeah. already have got a high reputation. We want to sort of give opportunity to people who might not necessarily even push themselves forward. And mm-hmm. definitely want, we took a diversity lens to the recruitment of it as best we could. And so what happens is those group of people receive all the papers ahead of the meeting. They will meet and I sometimes they want me there, sometimes they don't want me there, mm-hmm. and that's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. When I attend those meetings with them, I basically say, I'm here to respond to your questions. I'm not going to guide you on your opinions on here because that ruins the point of it. So they give their opinion. And then when we get to the actual meeting itself, we have the chair of the shadow committee come in and give their views. And we've just done an evaluation of this running for 6-7 months or something now.
Mm-hmm.
Feedback is really, really brilliant, both from the shadow committee members themselves and also from the committee about the value that they add. Mm-hmm. I've got a paper that's going to our trust leadership team at the start of April that basically says, okay, I've now got a set of collateral that shows you, here's how you set one of these things up, right? You don't even have to think about it, right? Yeah. Here's a terms of reference for you.
Yeah.
Here's an expression of interest form. Here's how you run the meetings, right? And I'm basically going to challenge my colleagues to say, look, there's 14 meetings that feed into our senior executive meeting, right? Only one of them's got a shadow committee. What are we going to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and I don't feel there's any excuse because it's like, I've done it all for you, right? So you just can take this off the shelf. So, and I guess the sort of motivation behind that, there's something around the moral imperative, of course, about giving colleagues an opportunity and a development path that they wouldn't necessarily be.
Yeah.
And also this thing about them spending time with more senior members of the organisation and raising their profile, which is likely to link to sponsorship.
Yes.
But if you put the moral thing aside,
mm-hmm.
what we know is actually diversity in decision-making leads to better decisions. So it makes good business sense as well. So
absolutely.
Again, 2020 was a bit of a year of this. So I'll mention another book. I read mm-hmm. Matthew Syed's Rebel Ideas, which talks about this diversity of thinking. It makes just really, really sound decision making. So that's kind of where it came from. And we will get to a position where we have a shadow board of our main trust board.
Mm-hmm.
I've agreed it with the chair and the chief executive. What we need to do is have some of these feeder committees in that we've got people who are at least used to the way that committed and things work. And so I think that's been a really exciting thing to do. People have been so fantastically really contributed to it. And we have made better decisions as a result.
And I think that is what's so important, isn't it? How you, listening to what you shared there, it's so insightful, but really that bit about, like you said, how do we improve our decision-making? how do we actually bring that diversity of thought in? It's almost like win-win, isn't it? Mm. You just described that other sponsorship opportunity, exposing people, but also building up your governance process that's more fit for purpose, isn't it? Mm. To embrace and encourage diversity of thought and voice. Absolutely fantastic. So I should say, shouldn't I, that we have had one of your exec colleagues here before, Gilbert George, who I call the governance czar. But listening to what you're saying there, isn't it? It's about Gilbert holding that corporate governance portfolio, and this now aligning is what you're saying there, isn't it? We've now got the blueprint of how this can actually be part of our formal governance process across the piece.
Yeah, and just today I've been having a conversation with some colleagues sort of across the NHS in the digital world, and there's something, the Equity Charter that you've been part of, of course. Yes. And we were talking about this stuff that we've done with the Shadow Committee, and I basically said, well, I could probably wrap that collateral that's available within our organisation as being something that we can just, you know, offer it out to other people. So so that was a conversation today to try and sort of see how to progress that.
For sure. I mean, you know, my desire to bring you here, you know, kind of chasing you around, Andy, can you come on, was to talk about, you know, your proactive stance around allyship. But what's been marvelous here is actually to hear you talking about how you're trying to transform the kind of the way we do things around here, you know, and using your power and autonomy and influence in what you're holding to test out and drive change. I can really hear and see your transformation and change agent thinking coming through on that. And that's exactly why one of the reasons why we started Bravery in the Boardroom is what's working, what is turning the dial now. And that's what you're kind of really unpacking for us here. It's brilliant. Really, really refreshing to hear it, actually. So kind of building on it, you've sort of touched on it because you said about, you know, diversity of thought, more diverse ideas, it's good for business. And you mentioned your board. What difference does it make, in your opinion? You've sat on a few boards now to have a more diverse board.
Yeah, well, so certainly if everyone sat around the table has come from the same educational background, they've done the same route through, they've got the same experience, then we'll all sort of narrow down to you know, things within our own what we know, and that's no good, because that certainly doesn't represent the needs of our patients, who are, you know, come from a wide range of backgrounds, experience, and so by having that, that is what we need to do. We've done quite a lot to try and broaden the diversity of our board. Absolutely, we've done that in the last couple of years. But I really think the shadow board would be the way that you can really sort of turbocharge that and just say, do you know what, this decision that you're about to make, you know, it might not necessarily, the decision on the table by having those things is, have you considered these things, which, you know, is completely out of my normal lived experience. Mm-hmm. So you know that thing is going to affect this group of people.
Yes.
Or even from a positive point of view, did you know, here's an unintended positive consequence of what you're doing that you didn't realize. So, I think that's definitely an important part of it.
Okay, thank you. Because I asked that question as well, because whilst the case for change can feel quite powerful, and like you're well versed, you know, like look, you were able to quote some of your reds for me, right? You're quite well versed in this. We do still have colleagues who say, well, why is this important? Like, you know, why? So question may sound obvious at times, but actually we still have a wide number of senior leaders who are still saying, you know, I feel it's important, but I'm grappling with how to articulate that or to build that narrative. You know, colleagues who are working outside of the NHS, they don't have the res. So much as you can encourage them to, well, try, and what data do you have? Can you replicate any of this data set? They don't have the, you know, that type of data at their hand. So I think being able to just help people with some of that narrative, or when they're challenged. Because again, people can feel the passion and commitment, but when they get pushback, they don't know how to kind of counter it. So thank you. It's really helpful how you're explaining it so practically as well as to the difference that it makes here. So I wanted to ask you two questions here now about, you shared lots of advice and insights, but if I came back to our listeners who may be thinking, who we're kind of encouraging and asking to be braver in their allyship, What would you want to say to them? What would be your top tips for them in terms of stepping into more active allyship?
So I don't think you can go very far wrong with the Von Coghill's 7 A's of allyship. Mm-hmm. really, really helpful thing. And for me, the bit that sort of opened my eyes was the second day, the ask bit, which is around being curious and educating yourself. And that really was the sort of start of me sort of working out, gosh, I've got a privilege that I didn't realize. And there's some experiences that other colleagues have just by the color of their skin have a completely different experience of something that I don't have to try and think about. And so I guess, you know, the bit I would say is just start educating yourself, and you can't go far wrong with the 7 A's book, and also White Fragility. I've mentioned it several times, you know, 150 pages. I mean, who hasn't got time to read 150 pages?
I'd say. Fair shout. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's got a deliberately provocative title. I'd say get over yourself, you know, just have a read of it with an open mind. And I think that's really the key to doing it.
Okay. And we'll make sure we share in the show notes the links to both of those, because yes, Yvonne's framework is a really helpful practical guide, isn't it? So I think it does two things, doesn't it? It explains allyship in all the different facets, but then also, like you said, gives you that guide how you can put it into practice. And what about those who, like we were talking about, those who want to progress their careers and, you know, see a future in the boardroom, particularly if they're underrepresented, what would you want to say to them?
Well, I guess this is going to sound dead easy for me to say. There needs to be less people who look like me in the boardroom, but I recognise that comes from a position of privilege, because, you know, I'm at a certain time in my career where I've got that experience, and really it's around what do I do for those coming after me. I think for my career anyway, the bit was around delivery, and we talked about it right at the start. Is have you got some really sound stuff under your belt that says I've achieved this, right? And no one can take that away from me. And then it's being making sure other people know about that. So I know, talking to some colleagues and, you know, working on their applications forms with them, can be really modest about their achievements. So that I'm like saying, this is not the time to be modest when you're going through an application form. You know, you really need to make the, you know, sing and dance about the stuff that you've done. And so there's something about being you know, social media gives you a great platform to share about stuff, and this isn't about being arrogant. This is about just being able to share your achievements. You can amplify all those others in that, but there's definitely a opportunity through the different forums now to sort of be able to do that in a way that will help enhance reputations. And so and I guess the other thing I would say, that just on a practical note, is, you know, once you've got those delivery things, you know, think about the metrics that come with that, and then make sure that's captured in your application forms and the way you talk about it. Because I think the whole application and interview process is an art, isn't it? It's not a science, and there's many flaws to it. And actually, it was... I've written a series of blogs actually that was bitter, and it was absolutely based on conversations with colleagues from the Reach network to say, who were basically saying, I go for these jobs and I'm not getting either an interview or I have an interview, and they say, well, no, you didn't come across well. And so I basically said, okay, well, as a recruiting manager and somebody who's read loads and loads of these things, here's what I'd say to you about it. And so plug for that, there's four in the series. How not to suck at application forms, how not to suck at interviews, and then more recently is how not to suck at negotiations when you offer the job, right? Because we know people, and this came out of a conversation on International Women's Day, lots of colleagues just say, well, I'll just accept whatever they say. It's like, no, that's your most powerful moment to negotiate.
Absolutely.
Right? And then I've done a final one, is how not to suck in your first 100 days in your job. Right. So there's a series there that basically says, okay, well, you know, I'm not saying this is magic, but it's basically from my experience and from my point of view, here are a few things to take into account.
I think it's so useful, because I know after this episode goes out, and I know for every platform that you've been on, I bet you know, people are literally banging down your virtual door. We always say the same thing on this conversation, and, you know, here on the podcast, that there aren't enough mentors to go around, you know, for mentors who people can trust, you know, mentors who people feel, you know, they can, that will make a difference for them, you get inundated. It's one of the reasons why we started the podcast, so that actually the episodes can be like a mentoring conversation. Right. So your series, I think, is magic because we've got many colleagues who won't have an Andy, you know, in their organization. And so that sponsorship opportunity isn't really there. That mentorship opportunity isn't really there. So actually the insight, the tips, the advice, even if it's one takeaway from those four blogs, I think will be so useful. So we will make sure we link those as well. I feel like this has been a little mini masterclass, right? I do. Alongside the conversation that we had, I think actually if you listen to this and you read the recommended books and you follow the blogs for all facets of our audience, isn't it? People who want to be more active allies, colleagues who are underrepresented who want to progress, people who are interested in digital, right?
Yeah.
I think you've shared insights and all that. Senior colleagues who are thinking about actually what's the fundamental building blocks we can be putting in to build more inclusive cultures. I mean, you shared so much on that as well. It's been marvelous. So, you know what I'm going to ask you now? Where can listeners kind of learn and hear more from you?
So I do got a social media on the Blue Sky. So I've ditched X. And LinkedIn primarily. And then my blogs are on the Medium platform. You can find me, Andy Callow, easy to find.
We'll put the link in for that as well. And so listening to all of that, and okay, I can hear you're a very busy man. I always like to finish off with how do you maintain balance and look after your well?
Probably three things. Love reading. Try and read 50 books a year. That's my sort of target. I love cycling, but I'm quite slow. But that really gets me out into the countryside. I love that. And then playing football. I still believe I can play football, so okay. I still go play that, and then follow in Boston United when I can.
Okay, Andy, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a wonderful conversation, and just thank you for all you're doing too. Really refreshing to hear about it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.